Is she... he began.
Yes, Jem said. I think she's quite dead this time.
But Will was shaking his head.
Dead?
You know, I don't think so.
What do you think, then?
Instead of answering, Will went and knelt down by the body. He put two fingers to the side of the woman's cheek and turned her head gently until she faced them. Her mouth was wide, her right eye staring at the ceiling. The left dangled halfway down her cheek, attached to its socket by a coil of copper wire.
"She's not alive," said Will. "But not dead, either. She may be...
like one of Henry's gadgets, I think." He touched her face.
"Who could have done this?"
"I can hardly guess. But she called us Nephilim. She knew what we are."
"Or someone did," said Will. "I don't imagine she knows anything. I think she's a machine like a clock, and she has run down."
He stood up. "Regardless, we had best get her back to the Institute. Henry will want to have a look at her." Jem did not reply. He was looking down at the woman on the floor. Her feet were bare beneath the hem of her dress, and dirty. Her mouth was open, and he could see the gleam of metal inside her throat. Her eye dangled eerily on its bit of copper wire as somewhere outside the windows a church clock chimed the midday hour. Once inside the park, Tessa found herself beginning to relax. She hadn't been in a green, quiet place since she'd come to London, and she found herself almost reluctantly delighted by the sight of grass and trees, though she thought the park nowhere near as fine as Central Park in New York. The air was not as hazy here as it was over the rest of the city, and the sky overhead had achieved a color that was almost blue. Thomas waited with the carriage while the girls made their promenade. As Tessa walked beside Jessamine, the other girl kept up a constant stream of chatter. They were making their way down a broad thoroughfare that Jessamine informed her was inexplicably called Rotten Row. Despite the inauspicious name, it was apparently the place to see and be seen. Down the center of it paraded men and women on horseback, exquisitely attired, the women with their veils flying, their laughter echoing in the summer air. Along the sides of the avenue walked other pedestrians. Chairs and benches were set up under the trees, and women sat twirling colorful parasols and sipping peppermint water. Beside them, bewhiskered gentlemen smoked, filling the air with the smell of tobacco mixed with cut grass and horses. Though no one stopped to talk to them, Jessamine seemed to know who everyone was. Who was getting married, who was seeking a husband, who was having an affair with so-and-so's wife, and everyone knew all about it. It was a bit dizzying, and Tessa was glad when they stepped off the row and onto a narrower path leading into the park. Jessamine slid her arm through Tessa's and gave her hand a companionable squeeze.
"You don't know what a relief it is to finally have another girl around," she said cheerfully. "I mean, Charlotte's all right, but she's boring and married."
"There's Sophie," Jessamine snorted.
"Sophie's a servant."
"I've known girls who were quite companionable with their ladies' maids," Tessa protested. This was not precisely true. She had read about such girls, though she had never known one. Still, according to novels, the main function of a lady's maid was to listen to you as you poured your heart out about your tragic love life, and occasionally to dress in your clothes and pretend to be you so you could avoid being captured by a villain. Not that Tessa could picture Sophie participating in anything like that on Jessamine's behalf.
"You've seen what her face looks like.
Being hideous has made her bitter. A lady's maid is meant to be pretty and speak French, and Sophie can't manage either. I told Charlotte as much when she brought the girl home. Charlotte didn't listen to me. She never does."
"I can't imagine why," said Tessa.
They had turned onto a narrow path that wound between trees. The glint of the water was visible through them, and the branches above knotted together into a canopy, blocking the brightness of the sun.
"I know, neither can I,"
Jessamine raised her face, letting what sun broke through the canopy dance across her skin.
"Charlotte never listens to anyone. She's always henpecking poor Henry. I don't know why he married her at all."
"I assume because he loved her," Jessamine snorted.
No one thinks that. Henry wanted access to the Institute so he could work on his little experiments in the cellar and not have to fight. And I don't think he minded marrying Charlotte. I don't think there was anyone else he wanted to marry. But if someone else had been running the Institute, he would have married them instead. She sniffed. And then there's the boys, Will and Jem. Jem's pleasant enough, but you know how foreigners are. Not really trustworthy and basically selfish and lazy. He's always in his room pretending to be ill, refusing to do anything to help out. Jessamine went on blithely, apparently forgetting the fact that Jem and Will were off searching the Dark House right now, while she promenaded in the park with Tessa. And Will, handsome enough, but behaves like a lunatic half the time. It's as if he were brought up by savages. He has no respect for anyone or anything, no concept of the way a gentleman is supposed to behave. I suppose it's because he's Welsh. Tessa was baffled. Welsh? Is that a bad thing to be? She was about to add, but Jessamine, thinking that Tessa was doubting Will's origins, went on with relish. Oh, yes, with that black hair of his, you can absolutely tell. His mother was a Welsh woman. His father fell in love with her, and that was that. He left the Nephilim. Maybe she cast a spell on him. Jessamine laughed. They have all kinds of odd magic and things in Wales, you know. Tessa did not know. Do you know what happened to Will's parents? Are they dead? I suppose they must be, mustn't they? Or they would have come looking for him. Jessamine furrowed her brow. Ugh, anyway, I don't want to talk about the Institute any more. She swung around to look at Tessa. You must be wondering why I've been being so nice to you. Tessa had been wondering, rather. In novels, girls like herself, girls whose families had once had money but who had fallen on hard times, were often taken in by kindly wealthy protectors and were furnished with new clothes and a good education. Not, Tessa thought, that there had been anything wrong with her education. Aunt Harriet had been as learned as any governess. Of course, Jessamine did not in any way resemble the saintly older ladies of such tales whose acts of generosity were totally selfless. Jessamine, have you ever read The Lamplighter? Certainly not. Girls shouldn't read novels, said Jessamine in the tone of someone reciting something she'd heard somewhere else. Regardless, Miss Gray, I have a proposition to put to you. Tessa corrected automatically. Of course, for we are already the best of friends, Jessamine said, and shall soon be even more so. Tessa regarded the other girl with bafflement. What do you mean? As I'm sure horrid Will has told you, my parents, my dear papa and mama, are dead, but they left me a not inconsiderable sum of money. It was put aside in trust for me until my 18th birthday, which is only in a matter of months. You see the problem, of course.
Tessa, who did not see the problem, said, I do?
I'm not a shadow hunter, Tessa. I despise everything about the Nephilim. I have never wanted to be one, and my dearest wish is to leave the Institute and never speak to a single soul who resides there ever again.
But I thought that your parents were shadow hunters.
One does not have to be a shadow hunter if one does not wish to, Jessamine snapped. My parents did not. They left the Clave when they were young. Mama was always perfectly clear. She never wanted the shadow hunters near me. She said she would never wish that life on a girl. She wanted other things for me. That I would make my debut, meet the Queen, find a good husband, and have darling little babies. An ordinary life.
She said the words with a savage sort of hunger.
There are other girls in this city right now, Tessa, other girls my age, who aren't as pretty as me, who are dancing and flirting and laughing and catching husbands. They get lessons in French. I get lessons in horrid demon languages. It's not fair.
You can still get married, Tessa was puzzled. Any man would...
I could marry a shadow hunter, Jessamine spat out the word. And live like Charlotte, having to dress like a man and fight like a man. It's disgusting. Women aren't meant to behave like that. We are meant to graciously preside over lovely homes, to decorate them in a manner that is pleasing to our husbands, to uplift and comfort them with our gentle and angelic presence.
Jessamine sounded neither gentle nor angelic, but Tessa forbore mentioning this. I don't see how I...
Jessamine caught Tessa's arm fiercely.
Don't you? I can leave the Institute, Tessa, but I cannot live alone. It wouldn't be respectable. Perhaps if I were a widow, but I'm only a girl, it just isn't done. But if I had a companion, a sister...
You wish me to pretend to be your sister? Tessa squeaked.
Why not?
Jessamine said, as if this were the most reasonable suggestion in the world.
Or you could be my cousin from America. Yes, that would work.
You do see, she added more practically, that it isn't as if you have anywhere else to go, is it? I'm quite positive we would catch husbands in no time at all. Tessa, whose head had begun to ache, wished Jessamine would cease to speak of catching husbands the way one might catch a cold or a runaway cat.
I could introduce you to all the best people, Jessamine continued. There would be balls and dinner parties.
She broke off, looking around in sudden confusion.
But where are we?
Tessa glanced around. The path had narrowed. It was now a dark trail leading between high twisted trees. Tessa could no longer see the sky nor hear the sound of voices. Beside her, Jessamine had come to a halt, her face creased with sudden fear.
We've wandered off the path, she whispered.
Well, we can find our way back, can't we? Tessa spun around, looking for a break in the trees, a patch of sunlight. I think we came from that way. Jessamine caught suddenly at Tessa's arm, her fingers claw-like. Something, no, someone, had appeared before them on the path. The figure was small, so small that for a moment Tessa thought they were facing a child. But as the form stepped forward into the light, she saw that it was a man, a hunched, wizened-looking man, dressed like a peddler in ragged clothes, a battered hat pushed back on his head. His face was wrinkled and white, like a mold-covered old apple, and his eyes were gleaming black between thick folds of skin. He grinned, showing teeth as sharp as razors.
Pretty girls.
Tessa glanced at Jessamine. The other girl was rigid and staring, her mouth a white line.
We ought to go, Tessa whispered and pulled at Jessamine's arm.
Slowly, as if she were in a dream, Jessamine allowed Tessa to turn her so they faced back the way they had come. And the man was before them once again, blocking the way back to the park. Far, far in the distance, Tessa thought she could see the park, a sort of clearing full of light. It looked impossibly far away.
"You wandered off the path," said the stranger. His voice was sing-song rhythmic. "Pretty girls, you wandered off the path. You know what happens to girls like you."
He took a step forward. Jessamine, still rigid, was clutching her parasol as though it were a lifeline.
"Goblin," she said. "Hobgoblin, whatever you are. We have no quarrel with any of the fair folk, but if you touch us..."
"You wandered from the path," sang the little man coming closer, and as he did, Tessa saw that his shining shoes were not shoes after all, but gleaming hooves. "Foolish Nephilim to come to this place unmarked. Here's land more ancient than any accords. Here there is strange earth. If your angel blood should fall upon it, golden vines will grow from the spot with diamonds at their tips, and I claim it, I claim your blood."
Tessa tugged at Jessamine's arm. "Jessamine, we should..."
"Tessa, be quiet."
Shaking her arm free, Jessamine pointed her parasol at the goblin. "You don't want to do this. You don't want..." The creature sprang. As he hurtled toward them, his mouth seemed to peel wide, his skin splitting, and Tessa saw the face beneath, fanged and vicious. She screamed and stumbled backward, her shoe catching on a tree root. She thumped to the ground as Jessamine raised her parasol, and with a flick of Jessamine's wrist, the parasol burst open like a flower. The goblin screamed. He screamed and fell back and rolled on the ground, still screaming. Blood streamed from a wound in his cheek, staining his ragged gray jacket.
"I told you,"
Jessamine said. She was breathing hard, her chest rising and falling as if she had been racing through the park.
"I told you to leave us alone, you filthy creature."
She struck at the goblin again, and now Tessa could see that the edges of Jessamine's parasol gleamed an odd gold white and were as sharp as razors. Blood was splattered across the flowered material. The goblin howled, throwing up his arms to protect himself. He looked like a little old hunched man now, and though Tessa knew it was an illusion, she couldn't help feeling a pang of pity.
"Mercy, mistress, mercy.
Mercy!" Jessamine spat. "You wanted to grow flowers out of my blood, filthy goblin, disgusting creature." She slashed at him again with the parasol, and again, and the goblin screamed and thrashed. Tessa sat up, shaking the dirt out of her hair, and staggered to her feet. Jessamine was still screaming, the parasol flying, the creature on the ground spasming with each blow.
"I hate you,"
Jessamine shrieked, her voice thin and trembling.
"I hate you and everything like you, downworlders, disgusting, disgusting."
"Jessamine." Tessa ran to the other girl and threw her arms around her, pinning Jessamine's arms against her body. For a moment, Jessamine struggled, and Tessa realized there was no way she could hold her. She was strong, the muscles under her soft feminine skin coiled and as tense as a whip. And then Jessamine went suddenly limp, sagging back against Tessa, her breath hitching as the parasol drooped in her hand.
"No," she wailed. "No, I didn't want to. I didn't mean to. No."
Tessa glanced down. The goblin's body was humped and motionless at their feet. Blood spread across the ground from the place where he lay, running across the earth like dark vines. Holding Jessamine as she sobbed, Tessa could not help but wonder what would grow there now. It was, unsurprisingly, Charlotte who recovered from her astonishment first.
"Mr. Mortmain, I'm not sure what you could possibly mean."
"Of course you are," he was smiling, his lean face split from ear to ear by an impish grin. "Shadow hunters, the Nephilim, that's what you call yourselves, isn't it? The by-blows of men and angels. Strange, since the Nephilim in the Bible were hideous monsters, weren't they?"
"You know, that's not necessarily true," Henry said, unable to restrain his inner pedant. "There's an issue of translation from the original Aramaic."
"Henry," Charlotte said warningly.
"Do you really trap the souls of the demons you kill in a gigantic crystal?" Mortmain went on wide-eyed. "How magnificent!" "Do you mean the Pyxis?" Henry looked baffled. "It's not a crystal, more like a wooden box. And they aren't so much souls. Demons don't have souls. They have energy."
"Be quiet, Henry," Charlotte snapped.
"Mrs. Branwell," Mortmain said. He sounded dreadfully cheerful. "Please do not concern yourself. I already know everything about your kind, you see. You're Charlotte Branwell, aren't you? And this is your husband, Henry Branwell. You run the London Institute from the site of what was once the Church of All Hallows the Less. Did you honestly think I wouldn't know who you were? Especially once you tried to glamour my footman. He can't bear being glamoured, you know. Gives him a rash."
Charlotte narrowed her eyes.
"And how have you come by all this information?"
Mortmain leaned forward eagerly, templing his hands.
"I am a student of the occult. Since my time in India as a young man when I first learned of them, I have been fascinated with the shadow realms. For a man in my position with sufficient funds and more than sufficient time, many doors are open. There are books one may purchase, information that can be paid for. Your knowledge is not a secret as you might think."
"Perhaps," said Henry, looking deeply unhappy. "But it is dangerous, you know, killing demons. It's not like shooting tigers. They can hunt you as well as you can hunt them."
Mortmain chuckled. "My boy, I have no intention of racing out to fight demons barehanded. Of course this sort of information is dangerous in the hands of the flighty and the hot-headed, but mine is a careful and sensible mind. I seek only an expansion of my knowledge of the world, nothing more."
He looked about the room.
"I must say, I've never had the honor of talking to Nephilim before."
Of course, mention of you is frequent in the literature, but to read about something and to experience it are two very different things, I'm sure you'll agree. There is so very much you could teach me.
That, Charlotte said in a freezing tone, will be quite enough of that.
Mortmain looked at her puzzled.
Pardon me?
Since you seem to know so much about Nephilim, Mr. Mortmain, might I ask if you know what our mandate is?
Mortmain looked smug.
To destroy demons, to protect humans, mundanes, as I understand you call us.
Yes, said Charlotte, and a great deal of the time what we are protecting humans from is their own very foolish selves.
I see that you are no exception to this rule.
At that, Mortmain looked actually astonished. His glance went to Henry.
Charlotte knew that look. It was a look only exchanged between men, a look that said, "Can you not control your wife, sir?" A look, she knew, that was quite wasted on Henry, who seemed to be trying to read the upside-down blueprints on Mortmain's desk, and was paying very little attention to the conversation.
"You think the occult knowledge you have acquired makes you very clever," said Charlotte. "But I have seen my share of dead mundanes, Mr. Mortmain. I cannot count the times we have attended to the remains of some human who fancied himself expert in magical practices. I remember, when I was a girl, being summoned to the home of a barrister. He belonged to some silly circle of men who believed themselves to be magicians. They spent their time chanting and wearing robes and drawing pentagrams on the ground. One evening he determined that his skill was sufficient to attempt the raising of a demon."
"And was it?"
"It was," Charlotte said. "He raised the demon Marix. It proceeded to slaughter him and all of his family." Her tone was matter-of-fact. "We found most of them hanging headless upside down in the carriage house. The youngest of his children was roasting on a spit over the fire. We never did find Marix."
Mortmain had paled, but retained his composure.
"There are always those who overreach their abilities," he said.
But you would never be so foolish," Charlotte said. "Save that you are, at this moment, being that foolish. You look at Henry and myself, and you are not afraid of us. You are amused. A fairy tale come to life."
She slammed her hand down hard on the edge of his desk, making him jump.
"The might of the clave stands behind us," she said in as cold a tone as she could muster. "Our mandate is to protect humans, such as Nathaniel Gray. He has vanished, and something occult is clearly behind that vanishing. And here we find his erstwhile employer clearly steeped in matters of the occult. It beggars belief that the two facts are not connected."
Mr. Gray has vanished?"
Mortmain stammered.
"He has. His sister came to us searching for him. She had been informed by a pair of warlocks that he was in grave danger. While you, sir, are amusing yourself, he may be dying, and the clave does not look kindly on those who stand in the way of its mandate."
Mortmain passed a hand over his face. When he emerged from behind it, he looked gray.
"I shall, of course," he said, "tell you whatever you want to know."
"Excellent."
Charlotte's heart was beating fast, but her voice betrayed no anxiety.
"I used to know his father, Nathaniel's father. I employed him almost 20 years ago when Mortmain's was mainly a shipping concern. I had offices in Hong Kong, Shanghai, Tianjin."
He broke off as Charlotte tapped her fingers impatiently on the desk.
"Richard Gray worked for me here in London. He was my head clerk, a kind and clever man. I was sorry to lose him when he moved his family to America. When Nathaniel wrote to me and told me who he was, I offered him a job on the spot."
"Mr. Mortmain," Charlotte's voice was steely, "this is not germane."
"Oh, but it is," the small man insisted. "You see, my knowledge of the occult has always been of assistance to me in business matters. Some years ago, for instance, a well-known Lombard Street bank collapsed, destroyed dozens of large companies. My acquaintance with a warlock helped me avoid disaster. I was able to withdraw my funds before the bank dissolved, and that saved my company. But it raised Richard's suspicions. He must have investigated, for eventually he confronted me with his knowledge of the Pandemonium Club.
You are a member, then? Charlotte murmured.
Of course. I offered Richard membership in the club. Even took him to a meeting or two, but he was uninterested. Shortly after that, he moved his family to America. Mortmain spread his hands wide. The Pandemonium Club is not for everyone. Travelling widely as I have, I heard stories of similar organizations in many cities. Groups of men who know of the shadow world and wish to share their knowledge and advantages. But one pays the heavy price of secrecy for membership.
One pays a heavier price than that.
It isn't an evil organization, Mortmain said.
He sounded almost wounded.
There were many great advancements, many great inventions. I saw a warlock create a silver ring that could transport the wearer to another location whenever he twisted one around his finger. Or a doorway that could bring you anywhere in the world you wanted to go. I've seen men brought back from the brink of death.
I'm aware of magic and what it can do, Mr. Mortmain.
Charlotte glanced at Henry, who was examining a blueprint for some sort of mechanical gadget mounted on the wall.
There is one question that concerns me. The warlocks who appear to have kidnapped Mr. Gray are somehow associated with the club. I have always heard it called a club for mundanes. Why would there be downworlders in it?
Mortmain's forehead creased.
Downworlders? You mean the supernatural folk, warlocks and lycanthropes and the like? There are levels and levels of membership, Mrs. Branwell. A mundane such as myself can become a member of the club, but the chairman, those who run the enterprise, they are downworlders, warlocks, lycanthropes and vampires. The fair folk shun us, though. Too many captains of industry, railroads, factories and the like for them. They hate such things.
He shook his head.
Lovely creatures, fairies, but I do fear progress will be the death of them.
Charlotte was uninterested in Mortmain's thoughts on fairies. Her mind was whirling.
Let me guess. You introduced Nathaniel Gray to the club exactly as you had introduced his father.
Mortmain, who had seemed to be regaining a bit of his old confidence, wilted again.
Nathaniel had worked in my office in London for only a few days before he confronted me. I gathered he had learned of his father's experience at the club, and it had given him a fierce desire to know more. I couldn't refuse. I brought him to a meeting and thought that would be the end of it, but it wasn't.
He shook his head.
Nathaniel took to the club like a duck to water.
A few weeks after that first meeting, he was gone from his lodging house. He sent a letter for me, terminating his employment and saying he was going to work for another Pandemonium Club member, someone who apparently was willing to pay him enough to sustain his gambling habits. He sighed.
Needless to say, he left no forwarding address.
And that's all?
Charlotte's voice rose in disbelief.
You didn't try to look for him? Find out where he had gone? Who his new employer was?
A man can take employment where he likes,
Mortmain said, blustering.
There was no reason to think.
And you haven't seen him since?
No, I told you.
Charlotte cut him off.
You say he took to the Pandemonium Club like a duck to water, yet you haven't seen him at a single meeting since he left your employment?
A look of panic flickered in Mortmain's eyes.
I've not been to a meeting since then myself. Work has kept me extremely busy.
Charlotte looked hard at Axel Mortmain across his massive desk. She was a good judge of character, she had always thought. It wasn't as if she hadn't come across men like Mortmain before. Bluff, genial, confident men. Men who believed that their success in business or some otherworldly pursuit meant that they would have the same success should they choose to pursue the magical arts. She thought of the barrister again, the walls of his Knightsbridge house painted scarlet with the blood of his family. She thought what his terror might have been like in those last moments of his life. She could see the beginnings of a similar fear in Axel Mortmain's eyes.
"Mr. Mortmain," she said, "I am not a fool. I know there is something you are concealing from me."
She took from her reticule one of the cogs that Will had retrieved from the Dark Sister's house and set it on the desk.
This looks like something your factories might produce.
With a distracted look, Mortmain glanced down at the small piece of metal on his desk.
Yes, yes, that's one of my cogs. What of it?
Two warlocks calling themselves the Dark Sisters, both members of the Pandemonium Club, they've been murdering humans. Young girls, barely more than children. And we found this in the cellar of their home.
I've nothing to do with any murders, Mortmain exclaimed. I thought...
He had begun to sweat. What did you think? Charlotte's voice was soft. Mortmain picked up the cog in shaking fingers.
You can't imagine.
His voice trailed off.
A few months ago, one of the club's board members, a downworlder, and very old and powerful, came to me and asked me to sell him some mechanical equipment cheaply, cogs and cams and the like. I didn't ask what it was for. Why would I? There seemed nothing remarkable about the request.
By any chance, Charlotte said, was this the same man whose employment Nathaniel joined after he left yours? Mortmain dropped the cog. As it rolled across the table, he slammed his hand down on top of it, halting its progress. Though he said nothing, Charlotte could tell by the flicker of fear in his eyes that her guess was correct. A tingle of triumph ran through her nerves.
His name, she said. Tell me his name.
Mortmain was staring at the desk.
It would be worth my life to tell you.
What about Nathaniel Gray's life? Said Charlotte. Without meeting her eyes, Mortmain shook his head.
You have no idea how powerful this man is. How dangerous.
Charlotte straightened up.
Henry, she said. Henry, bring me the summoner.
Henry turned away from the wall and blinked at her in confusion.
But, darling.
Bring me the device,
Charlotte snapped. She loathed snapping at Henry. It was like kicking a puppy, but sometimes it had to be done. The look of confusion didn't leave Henry's face as he joined his wife before Mortmain's desk and drew something from his jacket pocket. It was a dark metal oblong with a series of peculiar-looking dials across the face of it. Charlotte took it and brandished it at Mortmain.
"This is a summoner," she told him. "It will allow me to summon the Clave. Inside of 3 minutes they will surround your house. Nephilim will drag you from this room screaming and kicking. They will perform upon you the most exquisite tortures until you are forced to speak."
"Do you know what happens to a man when demon blood is dripped into his eyes?" Mortmain gave her a ghastly look but said nothing.
"Please don't test me, Mr. Mortmain."
The device in Charlotte's hand was slippery with sweat, but her voice was even.
"I would hate to watch you die."
"Good Lord, man, tell her,"
Henry burst out.
"Really, there's no need for this, Mr. Mortmain. You're only making it harder on yourself."
Mortmain covered his face with his hands. He had always wanted to meet real shadow hunters, Charlotte thought, looking at him. And now he had.
"De Quincey," he said. "I don't know his first name, just De Quincey."
"By the angel." Charlotte exhaled slowly, lowering the device to her side.
"De Quincey?
It can't be..."
"You know who he is?"
Mortmain's voice was dull.
"Well, I suppose you would."
"He's the head of a powerful London vampire clan," Charlotte said almost reluctantly. "A very influential downworlder and an ally of the Clave. I can't imagine that he would..."
"He's the head of the club," said Mortmain. He looked exhausted and a little gray. "Everyone else answers to him."
"The head of the club. Has he a title?"
Mortmain looked faintly surprised to be asked.
"The Magister."
With a hand that shook only slightly, Charlotte slipped the device she'd been holding into her sleeve.
"Thank you, Mr. Mortmain. You've been most helpful."
Mortmain looked at her with a sort of drained resentment.
De Quincey will find out what I've told you. He'll have me killed.
The Clave will see that he does not. And we will keep your name out of this. He shall never know you spoke to us.
You would do that, Mortmain said softly. For what was it? A foolish mundane.
I have hopes for you, Mr. Mortmain. You seem to have realized your own folly. The Clave will be watching you, not only for your own protection, but to see that you stay away from the Pandemonium Club and organizations like it. For your own sake, I hope you will regard our meeting as a warning.
Mortmain nodded. Charlotte moved to the door, Henry behind her. She already had it open and was standing on the threshold when Mortmain spoke again.
They were only cogs, he said softly. Only gears. Harmless.
It was Henry, to Charlotte's surprise, who replied without turning.
Inanimate objects are harmless indeed, Mr. Mortmain. But one cannot always say the same of the men who use them.
Mortmain was silent as the two shadow hunters left the room. A few minutes later they were out in the square breathing fresh air, as fresh as the air of London ever was.
It might be thick with coal smoke and dust, Charlotte thought,
but at least it was free of the fear and desperation that had hung like a haze in Mortmain's study. Drawing the device from her sleeve, Charlotte offered it to her husband.
I suppose I ought to ask you, she said as he received it with a grave expression. What is that object, Henry?
Something I've been working on. Henry looked at it fondly. A device that can sense demon energies. I was going to call it a sensor. I haven't got it working yet, but when I do, I'm sure it will be splendid.
Henry transferred his fond expression from the device to his wife. A rare occurrence.
What pure genius, Charlotte, pretending you could summon the Clave on the spot just to frighten that man. But how did you know I'd have a device you could put to your uses?
Well, you did, darling, said Charlotte. Didn't you?
Henry looked sheepish.
You are as terrifying as you are wonderful, my dear.
Thank you, Henry.
The ride back to the Institute was a silent one. Jessamine stared out the window of the cab at the snarling London traffic and refused to say a word. She held her parasol across her lap, seemingly indifferent to the fact that the blood on its edges was staining her taffeta jacket. When they reached the churchyard, she let Thomas help her down from the carriage before reaching to grip Tessa's hand. Surprised at the contact, Tessa could only stare. Jessamine's fingers in hers were icy.
Come along!
Jessamine snapped impatiently and pulled her companion toward the Institute doors, leaving Thomas staring after them. Tessa let the other girl draw her up the stairs, into the Institute proper and down a long corridor, this one almost identical to the one outside Tessa's bedroom. Jessamine located a door, pushed Tessa through it, and followed, shutting the door behind them.
"I want to show you something," she said.
Tessa looked around. It was another of the large bedrooms of which the Institute seemed to have an infinite number. Jessamine's, though, had been decorated somewhat to her taste. Above the wooden wainscoting, the walls were papered in rose silk, and the coverlet on the bed was printed with flowers. There was a white vanity table, too, its surface covered with an expensive-looking dressing table set, a ring stand, a bottle of flower water, and a silver-backed hairbrush and mirror.
"Your room is lovely," Tessa said, more in hopes of calming Jessamine's evident hysteria than because she meant it.
"It's much too small," Jessamine said. "But come over here."
And flinging the bloodied parasol down onto her bed, she marched across the room to a corner by the window. Tessa followed with some puzzlement. There was nothing in the corner but a high table, and on the table was a dollhouse. Not the sort of two-room cardboard dolly's playhouse that Tessa had had as a child. This was a beautiful miniature reproduction of a real London townhouse. And when Jessamine touched it, Tessa saw that the front of it swung open on tiny hinges.
Tessa caught her breath.
There were beautiful tiny rooms perfectly decorated with miniature furniture, everything built to scale. From the little wooden chairs with needlepoint cushions to the cast iron stove in the kitchen. There were small dolls, too, with china heads, and real little oil paintings on the walls.
This was my house.
Jessamine knelt down, bringing herself to eye level with the dollhouse rooms, and gestured for Tessa to do the same. Awkwardly, Tessa did, trying not to kneel on Jessamine's skirts. You mean this was the dollhouse you had when you were a little girl?
No,
Jessamine sounded irritated.
This was my house. My father had this made for me when I was 6. It's modeled exactly on the house we lived in on Curzon Street. This was the wallpaper we had in the dining room, she pointed. And those are exactly the chairs in my father's study. You see?
She looked at Tessa intently, so intently that Tessa felt sure she was supposed to be seeing something here, something beyond an extremely expensive toy that Jessamine should have long ago grown out of. She simply didn't know what that could be.
It's very pretty, she said finally. See, here in the parlor is Mama, said Jessamine, touching one of the tiny dolls with her finger.
The doll wobbled in its plush armchair.
And here in the study, reading a book, is Papa.
Her hand glided over the little porcelain figure.
And upstairs in the nursery is baby Jessie.
Inside the little crib there was indeed another doll, only its head visible above tiny coverlets.
Later they'll have dinner here in the dining room, and then Mama and Papa will sit in the drawing room by the fire. Some nights they go to the theater, or to a ball or a dinner.
Her voice had grown hushed as if she were reciting a well-remembered litany.
And then Mama will kiss Papa goodnight, and they will go to their rooms, and they will sleep all night long. There will be no calls from the clave that drive them out in the middle of the night to fight demons in the dark. There will be no one tracking blood into the house. No one will lose an arm or an eye to a werewolf or have to choke down holy water because a vampire attacked them.
Dear God, Tessa thought. As if Jessamine could read Tessa's mind, her face twisted.
When our house burned, I had nowhere else to go. It wasn't as if there were relations that could take me in. All of Mama and Papa's relations were shadow hunters and hadn't spoken to them since they'd broken with the clave. Henry's the one who made me that parasol. Did you know that? I thought it was quite pretty until he told me that the fabric is edged with electrum as sharp as a razor. It was always meant to be a weapon.
You saved us, Tessa said, in the park today. I can't fight at all. If you hadn't done what you did...
I shouldn't have done it.
Jessamine stared into the dollhouse with empty eyes.
I will not have this life, Tessa. I will not have it. I don't care what I have to do. I won't live like this. I'd rather die.
Alarmed, Tessa was about to tell her not to talk like that when the door opened behind them. It was Sophie in her white cap and neat dark dress. Her eyes, when they rested on Jessamine, were wary. She said,
Miss Tessa, Mr. Bramwell very much wants to see you in his study. He says it's important.
Tessa turned to Jessamine to ask if she would be all right, but Jessamine's face had closed like a door. The vulnerability and anger were gone. The cold mask was back.
Go along, then, if Henry wants you, she said. I'm quite tired of you already, and I think I'm getting a headache. Sophie, when you return, I'll need you to massage my temples with eau de cologne.
Sophie's eyes met Tessa's across the room with something like amusement.
As you like, Miss Jessamine.
7. The Clockwork Girl. But helpless pieces of the game he plays upon this checkerboard of nights and days, hither and thither moves, and checks and slays. The Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, translated by Edward Fitzgerald, 1859. It had grown dark outside the Institute, and Sophie's lantern cast strange dancing shadows on the walls as she led Tessa down one flight of stone stairs after another. The steps were old, concave in the centers, where generations of feet had worn them down.
The walls were roughly textured stone, the tiny windows set into them at intervals giving way eventually to blankness that seemed to indicate that they had passed below ground. "Sophie," Tessa said finally, her nerves rubbed raw by the darkness and silence. "Are we going down into the church crypt, by any chance?" Sophie chuckled, and the lights of the lantern flickered on the walls. "It used to be the crypt, before Mr. Branwell had it fixed up into a laboratory for himself. He's always down there tinkering with his toys and his experiments. It doesn't half drive Mrs. Branwell wild." "What's he making?" Tessa nearly tripped over an uneven stair and had to grab for the wall to right herself. Sophie didn't appear to notice. "All sorts of things," Sophie said, her voice echoing strangely off the walls. "Inventing new weapons, protective gear for the shadow hunters. He loves clockwork and mechanisms and that sort of thing. Mrs. Branwell sometimes says she thinks he'd love her better if she ticked like a clock." She laughed. "It sounds," Tessa said, "as if you're fond of them. Mr. and Mrs. Branwell, I mean." Sophie said nothing, but the already proud set of her back seemed to harden slightly. "Fonder of them than you are of Will, anyway," Tessa said, hoping to soften the other girl's mood with humor. "Him?" The disgust was plain in Sophie's voice. He's a bad sort, isn't he? Reminds me of the son of my last employer. He was proud just like Mr. Herondale. And whatever he wanted, he got from the day he was born, and if he didn't get it, well..." She reached up then, almost unconsciously, and touched the side of her face where the scar ran from mouth to temple. "Then what?" But Sophie's brusque manner was back. "Then he'd be like to pitch a fit, that's all." Transferring her glowing lantern from one hand to the other, she peered down into the shadowy darkness. "Be careful here, miss. The stairs can get awfully damp and slippery toward the bottom." Tessa moved closer to the wall. The stone was cold against her bare hand. "Do you think it's simply because Will's a shadow hunter?" she inquired. "And they, well, they rather think they're superior, don't they? Jessamine, too."
"But Mr. Carstairs is not like that. He isn't at all like the others. And neither are Mr. and Mrs. Branwell."
Before Tessa could say anything else, they came to an abrupt stop at the foot of the stairs. There was a heavy oak door there with a barred grill set into it. Tessa could see nothing through the grill but shadows. Sophie reached for the wide iron bar across the door and pushed it down hard. The door swung open onto an enormous, brightly lit space. Tessa moved into the room with wide eyes. This had clearly been the crypt of the church that had originally stood on this spot. Squat pillars held up a roof that disappeared into darkness. The floor was made up of great stone slabs darkened with age. Some were carved with words, and Tessa guessed that she stood on the gravestones, and the bones, of those who had been buried in the crypt. There were no windows, but the bright white illumination that Tessa had come to know as witch light shone down from brass fixtures fastened to the pillars. In the center of the room were a number of large wooden tables, their surfaces covered with all manner of mechanical objects. Gears and cogs made of dully shining brass and iron, long strings of copper wire, glass beakers filled with liquids of different colors, some of them giving off wisps of smoke or bitter odors. The air smelled metallic and sharp, like the air before a storm. One table was entirely covered with a scatter of weapons, the blades shining under the witch light. There was a half-finished suit of what looked like thinly scaled metal armor hanging on a wire frame by a great stone table whose surface was concealed by a lumpy cluster of thick woolen blankets. Behind the table stood Henry, and beside him Charlotte. Henry was showing his wife something he held in his hand, a copper wheel, perhaps a gear, and was speaking to her in a low voice. He wore a loose canvas shirt over his clothes like a fisherman's smock, and it was smeared with dirt and dark fluid. Still, what struck Tessa most about him was the assurance with which he spoke to Charlotte. There was none of his usual diffidence. He sounded confident and direct, and his hazel eyes, when he raised them to look at Tessa,
were clear and steady.
"Miss Gray, so Sophie showed you the way down here, did she? Very good of her."
"Why, yes, she..." Tessa began, glancing behind her, but Sophie was not there. She must have turned at the door and gone soundlessly back up the stairs. Tessa felt foolish for not having noticed.
"She did," she finished. "She said that you wanted to see me?"
"Indeed," Henry said. "We could use your help with something. Could you come over here for a moment?"
He gestured for her to join him and Charlotte by the table. As Tessa approached, she saw that Charlotte's face was white and pinched, her brown eyes shadowed. She looked at Tessa, bit her lip, and glanced down toward the table, where the heaped fabric moved. Tessa blinked. Had she imagined it? But no, there had been a flicker of movement. And now that she was closer, she saw that what was on the table was not so much a pile of fabric as fabric covering something. Something approximately the size and shape of a human body. She stopped in her tracks as Henry reached out, took hold of a corner of the fabric, and drew it away, revealing what lay beneath. Tessa, feeling suddenly dizzy, reached to grasp the edge of the table. Miranda. The dead girl lay on her back on the table, her arms flung out to either side, her dull brown hair straggling down around her shoulders. The eyes that had so unnerved Tessa were gone. Now there were hollow black sockets in her white face. Her cheap dress had been cut open down the front, baring her chest. Tessa winced, looked away, and then looked back quickly in disbelief. For there was no naked flesh and no blood, despite the fact that Miranda's chest had been sliced open down the front, her skin peeled back on either side like the skin of an orange. Beneath the grotesque mutilation gleamed the brightness of metal? Tessa moved forward until she was standing across from Henry at the table where Miranda lay. Where there should have been blood, torn flesh, and mutilation, there were only the two sheets of white skin folded back, and beneath them a carapace of metal. Sheets of copper, intricately fitted together, made up her chest, flowing smoothly down into a jointed cage of copper and flexible brass that was Miranda's waist. A square of copper, about the size of Tessa's palm, was missing from the center of the dead girl's chest, revealing a hollow space. "Tessa," Charlotte's voice was soft but insistent, "Will and Jem found this body in the house where you were kept. The house was completely empty except for her. She'd been left in a room alone." Tessa, still staring in fascination, nodded. "Miranda, the sister's maidservant. Do you know anything about her? Who she might be? Her history?" "No, no. I mean, she hardly ever spoke. And then she only repeated things the sisters had said." Henry hooked a finger into Miranda's lower lip and pulled her mouth open. "She has a rudimentary metal tongue, but her mouth was never really constructed for speech or for consuming food. She has no gullet, and I would guess no stomach. Her mouth ends in a sheet of metal behind her teeth." He turned her head from side to side, his eyes narrowing.
"But what is she?" Tessa asked. "A sort of downworlder or demon?"
"No." Henry let go of Miranda's jaw. "She is not precisely a living creature at all. She's an automaton, a mechanical creature made to move and appear as a human being moves and appears. Leonardo da Vinci designed one. You can find it in his drawings, a mechanical creature that could sit up, walk, and turn its head. He was the first to suggest that human beings are only complex machines, that our insides are like cogs and pistons and cams made of muscle and flesh. So why could they not be replaced with copper and iron? Why couldn't you build a person? But this! Jacques Aydreau and Maya Day could never have dreamt of this. A true biomechanical automaton, self-moving, self-directing, wrapped in human flesh." His eyes shone. "It's beautiful."
"Henry," Charlotte's voice was tight, "that flesh you're admiring, it came from somewhere."
Henry passed the back of his hand across his forehead, the light dying out of his eyes.
Yes, those bodies in the cellar.
The Silent Brothers have examined them.
Most are missing organs, hearts, livers. Some are missing bones and cartilage, even hair. We cannot but assume the Dark Sisters were harvesting these bodies for parts to create their mechanical creatures. Creatures like Miranda.
And the coachman, Tessa said. I think he was one as well. But why would anyone do such a thing?
There is more, Charlotte said. The mechanical tools in the Dark Sisters' cellar were manufactured by Mortmain and Company, the company your brother worked for.
Mortmain? Tessa tore her gaze from the girl on the table. You went to see him, didn't you? What did he say about Nate?
For a moment, Charlotte hesitated, glancing at Henry. Tessa knew that glance. It was the sort of glance people gave each other when they were preparing to engage in a joint falsehood. The sort of look she and Nathaniel had given each other once when they'd been concealing something from Aunt Harriet.
You're hiding something from me, she said. Where's my brother? What does Mortmain know?
Charlotte sighed. Mortmain is deeply involved in the occult underworld. He's a member of the Pandemonium Club, which seems to be run by downworlders.
But what does that have to do with my brother?
Your brother found out about the club and was fascinated by it. He went to work for a vampire named De Quincey, a very influential downworlder. De Quincey is, in fact, the head of the Pandemonium Club.
Charlotte sounded bitterly disgusted. There is a title to go with the job, it seems.
Feeling suddenly dizzy, Tessa braced her hand against the edge of the table. The Magister? Charlotte looked at Henry, who had his hand inside the creature's chest panel. He reached in and drew something out. A human heart, red and fleshy, but hard and shiny, looking as if it had been lacquered. It had been bound around with copper and silver wires. Every few moments it would give a listless thump. Somehow it was still beating.
"Would you like to hold it?"
he asked Tessa. "You'd have to be careful. These copper tubes wind throughout the creature's body, carrying oil and other flammable liquids. I have yet to identify them all."
Tessa shook her head.
"Very well." Henry looked disappointed. "There was something I wished you to see. If you'll simply look here."
He turned the heart carefully in his long fingers, revealing a flat metal panel on the opposite side of it. The panel had been etched with a seal, a large Q, a small D inside it.
De Quincey's mark, said Charlotte. She looked bleak. I've seen it before on correspondence from him. He's always been an ally of the Clave, or so I thought. He was there at the Accords when they were signed. He's a powerful man. He controls all the Night Children in the western part of the city. Mortmain says that De Quincey bought mechanical parts from him, and this would seem to bear that out. It looks as if you weren't the only thing in the Dark Sister's house that was being prepared for the Magister's use. These clockwork creatures were as well.
If this vampire is the Magister, Tessa said slowly, then he is the one who had the Dark Sisters capture me, and he is the one who forced Nate to write me that letter. He must know where my brother is.
Charlotte almost smiled. You are single-minded, aren't you? Tessa's voice was hard. Don't imagine that I don't want to know what the Magister wants with me, why he had me captured and trained, how on earth he knew I had my ability, and don't think I wouldn't want revenge if I could have it.
She took a shuddering breath. But my brother is all I have. I must find him.
We will find him, Tessa, Charlotte said. Somehow all of this, the Dark Sisters, your brother, your own ability, and De Quincey's involvement, fits together like a puzzle. We simply haven't found all the missing bits of it yet.
I must say I hope we find them soon, Henry said, casting a sad glance at the body on the table. What could a vampire want with a lot of half-mechanical people? None of this makes any sense.
Not yet, said Charlotte, and she set her small chin. But it will.
Henry remained in his laboratory even after Charlotte had announced that it was past time for them to return upstairs for supper. Insisting that he would be along in 5 minutes, he waved them off absently as Charlotte shook her head.
"Henry's laboratory, I've never seen anything like it," Tessa said to Charlotte.